So I'm not sure whether you have read about Zohran Mamdani's recent speech in the United States of America, New York City, talking about AIPAC. He referred to them as monsters. I happen to have read that. Sure, my reaction was visceral and my gut kind of wrenched reading those words. But it was not until I'd actually watched the speech on YouTube that I realized just how bad it was. It wasn't limited to just calling AIPAC monsters. It involved all sorts of interesting tropes that are nothing short of frightening, that the mayor of the largest Jewish city pretty much in the world would be using. To kind of help me understand what's going on here is Joel Pollack, the opinion editor for the California Post. As always, Joel, thank you so much for making time to chat to us here on Chai FM.
Good to have you.
So let's start with the basics, Joel. When a sitting mayor of New York City calls AIPAC and its supporters monsters in a city that already is battling record anti-Semitism, how does that land with you?
Well, what's interesting is that Mamdani is obsessed with Israel. It's the central organizing principle of his politics. He has not been an effective mayor at all, even though he has a small army of social media sycophants who try to tell you otherwise. He has been an ineffective mayor. A lot of his socialist policies have been pushed aside. He promised free buses, for example. That's never happening. And yet he is endorsing candidates whose main common policy is that they oppose Israel. And it doesn't even matter if they've been staunch Democrats, if they've been members of the Democratic establishment. It doesn't even matter if they elected him for mayor. He's getting rid of them if they're not anti-Israel enough. AIPAC is the American Israel Public Affairs Committee. It is a large lobbyist organization. It has thousands of grassroots supporters across the country, and it is basically the main pro-Israel group in the United States. Not specifically a Jewish group. It includes a large number of Christian activists as well. It has a very large college program, many volunteers, and an annual conference where they bring pro-Israel activists to Capitol Hill and meet with members of Congress and their staff to talk about the U.S. alliance with Israel. But AIPAC has also been fairly weak lately. It was unable to stop the Iran deal under Obama, for example, and AIPAC tried so hard to maintain a kind of facade of bipartisanship that when the Democratic Party started moving against Israel, AIPAC really started lowering the bar for what counted as pro-Israel. They would often include politicians as pro-Israel who had actually voted against Israel or criticized Israel as long as they voted for foreign or military aid for Israel. So many of us were critical of AIPAC because we saw it as ineffective, essentially spending a lot of money on protecting a political establishment in Washington, D.C. rather than in protecting the U.S. and Israel and our common interests. And in fact, I can tell you this, I was one of the only my own experience with being canceled at a speech, the only time I've ever been canceled was at an AIPAC event.
Goodness.
When left-wing donors objected. Wow. Yeah. I was invited to address a media panel with a number of other journalists on the left and the right. And somebody objected to my participation because they said I was too right-wing. And I guess they had a lot of money or influence, but AIPAC basically agreed and they canceled the panel. It was the only time I've ever been uninvited from something. So it tells you they were really, really cozying up to the left. In fact, in 2016, Donald Trump gave a speech at AIPAC in which he viciously attacked Barack Obama. And the members of AIPAC, the activists, they stood up and applauded. But the leadership of AIPAC was appalled because, again, they have to maintain this facade of bipartisanship. And so the next day they went on stage and they offered this groveling apology to Obama. So AIPAC has been very, very ineffective for at least a decade. And yet they've been made into this boogeyman by Mamdani and by the left, and they basically function as the protocols of the Elders of Zion in an American context. And, you know, instead of saying Jews control our politics, politicians, especially on the left, will say AIPAC controls our politics, although it's not exclusive to the left anymore. And that's what Mamdani is doing. He's basically saying AIPAC controls our politics. We're going to fight AIPAC, and these are monsters. What makes them monsters exactly? I mean, what makes them monsters in his mind is that they support Israel. Israel is monstrous to him. I mean, he was arrested protesting against Israel after October 7th. He is in favor of October 7th style violence. He was one of those protesters who went out there defending Palestinians against any effort by Israel to defend itself. Just really, really on the edge. And what's monstrous to him is that anybody would ever support Israel. So the fact that AIPAC's out there supporting Israel and donating to politicians who support Israel, that makes them monstrous in his imagination. But yes, he's using this kind of language, whether consciously or unconsciously, he's using this language that has become common on the extreme left and the extreme right, who are not so extreme anymore. I mean, especially on the left, this is in mainstream Democratic Party politics. And he's using this language, which does recall the sort of conspiracy theories of the Protocols of the Elders of Zion, to describe the way in which he believes AIPAC controls our politics. And you might say, what is a mayor of New York doing with all this? And it's because he's not really any kind of civic politician. He came up from the rabble in the streets after October 7th. He was carrying a bullhorn around, yelling at people about Israel, and there happened to be enough of an organization that grew around him. You know, in a sense, that became the organizing principle of the far left. And then he won an election that was split between a number of candidates. You know, in any ordinary election, he wouldn't have won. But the two mainstream Democrats, Andrew Cuomo, the former governor, and Eric Adams, the incumbent mayor, could not agree on which of them should drop out. So he basically won a three-way primary in the Democratic Party, which ensured that he would win in the fall. And then the Republican who was running against him was also a no-hoper who just wouldn't withdraw from the race for egotistical reasons or whatever. But he won a very unusual election, normally not the kind of person who gets elected. But there he is. He's the mayor of New York City. He's obsessed with hating Israel. He's chasing out investors because he's also a socialist. And, you know, as you point out, it's one of the most important cities in the Jewish world. It's probably the only city in the Western world with a Jewish holy site, that is the birth or the gravesite of the Lubavitcher Rebbe. I mean, it's an incredibly important city in the Jewish world, and to have a city with such a large Jewish population and a rich Jewish history governed by this hateful anti-Semite is really something. But you know, Austria, I mean, Vienna was governed by Karl Luger at the turn of the century, whom Hitler admired greatly. And he was an anti-Semitic mayor elected because enough Austrians were upset about the influx of Jewish intellectuals into Vienna and their dominance in the professions. So you're seeing something of a similar dynamic. And yeah, it's concerning.
It's concerning indeed. And if you watch him speak, it's these ideas of control and tentacles, which really do hark back to Russian Soviet style anti-Semitism. And it's interesting to me because you've said it's Israel, but it's also control and manipulation. And I'm just wondering, it's interesting, and I don't want to get into whataboutism because it's not a strong argument, but he doesn't mention the Qatari lobby groups at all, which outspend AIPAC by a factor of, I don't know, you probably know better than I do, but significantly outspend.
The Qataris and others spend hundreds of billions of dollars on not just American politics, but American institutions. And this is partly what they've been able to do with that money. They've been able to change American education and the American media. But the real issue here is just that the Democratic Party itself, and I know a lot of South Africans have a soft spot for it, the Democratic Party itself is completely adrift. It lost the elections in 2024 because it had no leadership and had no agenda. And that's not to say that you have to love everything Donald Trump is or does, but they have no agenda. And in a vacuum like that, you find that extremists with an agenda who are very well organized can rapidly take over. And the Democratic Party has become an extremist party, and anti-Israel fanaticism is one aspect of that extremism. But they have become socialists. I mean, it's, you know, in South African terms, I would describe it as a drift toward the EFF, really, in a party that's looking for an agenda.
It leaves the Jews pretty much politically homeless. You know, a couple of weeks in American politics makes a big...
I mean, I see the Jews, Jews have a home in the Republican Party. The Jews have a home in the Republican Party. That is to say, observant Jews. There are still, you know...
Do you think
the
so?
Jewish community in America is very segmented.
Despite the ceasefire talks that seem to be putting Israel in, the word that's been bandied about is catastrophic, a catastrophic position.
Well, but the difference is in a Republican Party, people who criticize the president are not drummed out of the party. I mean, there is more of a debate in the Republican Party. There are also people who speak up on behalf of Israel in conservative circles. In Democratic circles, they don't. I mean, one of the people, this is really ironic, but one of the people who is in trouble in New York is a congressman named Dan Goldman. Mm. He's really a terrible, terrible character. I mean, just an awful, awful person. But anyway, he's nominally pro-Israel. And so Mamdani is targeting him, and he's using this Jewish socialist named Brad Lander, who's sort of a Ronnie Caserles type. And this Ronnie Caserles type is winning in the polls against Dan Goldman. Dan Goldman's wife is very pro-Israel. And when this was exposed like some kind of scandal, he essentially threw his wife under the bus and said, well, you know, she does her own thing, I do mine. He didn't even defend his wife. So, you know, that's the mood right now in the Democratic Party. That, I think, doesn't happen in the Republican Party. In the Republican Party, Donald Trump campaigned against the Israel-hating Thomas Massie, who lost his primary in Kentucky. Now, you might say Trump and Vance have said some things that were not great about Israel over the last couple of weeks, but exactly. You do have many prominent Republicans speaking out against that. And I don't think anybody doubts that President Trump is supportive of Israel and protective of Israel. He's trying to find some formula that comes up with a deal with Iran. And, you know, some of this is strong-arming Israel into accepting concessions in Lebanon. And there's a bit of ugliness that seems to go along with that. But, look, I think Jews still have a home in the Republican Party. Whether Jews have a home in the broader conservative world is now an open question, because you have all these right-wing podcasters who've come out. I mean, I was listening to one of them yesterday. He used to be sort of reliably pro-Israel. Now he's foaming at the mouth, anti-Semite. You know, that media landscape has changed as well. So I wouldn't say that Jews have no political home, but it does raise questions about the Jewish future in the United States, really, for the first time. I mean, I don't think we've seen this, and it is the direct result of unchecked Muslim immigration, which has changed our politics, and it, you know, in the way that it's changed Europe. We're not quite there yet, but it's not slowing down in any real way. And the new immigrants are not adapting to their homeland by changing their beliefs. I participated throughout my youth in a lot of interfaith activities, a lot of discussions in the Muslim community. I lived in a Muslim community for many years. And I tell you that since October 7th, most of those relationships have fallen by the wayside, because the Muslim community is just absolutely crippled by its hatred of Israel and the underlying theological problems that Muslims have with Jews. And when you invite this unreconstructed group into your civilization, it has an effect. It's not like Americans woke up one day and decided to hate Israel. I mean, the catalyst for this has been the sudden increase in Muslim immigration under Barack Obama, which is still affecting us now. There were, you know, some Muslim immigrant communities that had anti-Israel views, but they were small and fairly isolated. And now they're exploding. They are absolutely exploding. And they will overtake Jews in terms of population in the United States at some point in the next 10 years. And they are becoming a very powerful voice within the Democratic Party.
Joel, final question for you. I just want to take you back to the Mamdani issue. In my naivety, I would have thought that he would have moderated his stance once he got into power for realpolitik reasons. It seems like I'm completely wrong. It seems like he's doubling down. Is it working for him? Is anti-Semitism a successful strategy for politicians in the Democratic Party these days?
It's working for him in terms of building a national profile. Now, he can't run for president because he wasn't born in the United States. In fact, he only became a citizen a few years ago. But it is working for him in that sense. It's not working for the city of New York. I mean, people who are thinking about investing in New York are running as far away as they possibly can. The joke about Mamdani is he is the most effective real estate agent in Florida, because people are leaving New York to go to Florida.
Okay.
Yeah, no, I mean, look, you have a familiar dynamic. I mean, people are looking, you know,
Wow.
In South Africa, people often are planning an exit strategy in case things go really badly. And that's how people are starting to think about cities like New York. I mean, they are getting out. They're getting out because who wants to subject themselves or their children to that?
Joel, that was sobering. Thank you so much for chatting to us here on Chai FM. That was Joel Pollack, opinion editor at the California Post.